Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively the Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back to On Air. We have so much to dive into. Dan, how are you? Where are you? And I need to hear more about this Emirates first class trip, because I've seen a bit of the YouTube video, but I'm saving to watch it properly tonight. Look at me saving things to watch.
Yeah.
And it's your content just generating you cash.
The video is a real treat. I recommend it to everyone because I had the pleasure of finding 3 award seats so that my mom, Oscar, and I could fly Emirates first class together. That was like a month ago now, but it was just the most fun you could possibly have. My mom got to take a shower, you know, because it's Emirates. She got to have unlimited caviar, Dom Perignon, all this stuff that just blew her mind. And it was so fun getting to see her indulge and be a diva for 7 hours.
Did you know that you were going to make this video as like a Mother's Day video? Because it was Mother's Day in several parts of the world on the Sunday just gone, including the US.
Yeah, I literally didn't realize it was Mother's Day until people started commenting when I posted the video on Saturday. And everyone was like, is this for Mother's Day? I was like, yes, it is 100% planned for Mother's Day, which it was not. But I had planned to post it now like for a month. So it just worked out perfectly.
Nice. That's cool.
I mean, and I know that now I'm very close to you. I'm outside your house. No, I'm kidding. But I'm in London.
You're in London. Amazing.
London, baby. And it brings us into a very relevant topic for this week, because I flew here via Delhi. And as I was in Delhi spending the night, it was the height of, will there be missiles fired at Delhi? Will there be nuclear wars? So let's just say that me and the Singapore Airlines crew that I flew in with to Delhi were all a bit like, and you know how Singaporeans are, that anywhere outside Singapore feels like the most dangerous ghetto on earth to them. So they were like, oh my God, we're just flying into a war zone. This is not nice.
Well, okay. The context to that all, and by the way, so while I've been in Paris over the last week, and I was looking at these developments, obviously keeping a track, I also did a bit of broadcasting about the airspace conflict between India and Pakistan. And then at the same time, you were sending me photos, but I couldn't keep up because I saw Etihad apartment, then I saw Singapore. I mean, you've just lived your best life over the last week while the world went to war and you were right there in the middle of it. Okay, thankfully, exaggerating a bit, the world hasn't gone to war. But once again, airspace is being used as a geopolitical weapon. And once again, either yourself or myself caught up in it. This time it was you. You say that you were leaving Delhi when all of these kind of toing and froing in terms of the airspace action and then the wider conflict and the different attacks have been ongoing. We'll leave all of the attack side to a whole different podcast who discuss that kind of thing, and we'll focus on the aviation bits. But were you concerned? Was there an impact on your flight? How did that all play out?
Well, I remember the morning of my flight to Delhi, and I was looking at, because obviously during the night, India and Pakistan were kind of going at it for a few days. So I remember looking at the map and trying to figure out how far from the border and how far from Kashmir are explosions actually going off. Because obviously, fortunately, Delhi, which is, you know, one of India's biggest population centers, is relatively far from the conflict zone, but still not very far compared to the likes of Mumbai or Bangalore or Hyderabad. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what is there any risk here? Of course, I'll be at an airport, which is a critical piece of infrastructure. Are there any military facilities at this airport? I was doing all this research as if I had a choice to change my trip, which I 100% didn't, because everything was non-refundable and I wasn't just, you know, the airlines weren't doing any waivers or anything like that. So I was just like, you know what? We'll do it. It's fine. And the good thing is that since I was flying Singapore Airlines, if there's any airline, or if there's, you know, a few airlines in the world that we trust to put safety as the number one priority before profits, before operational reliability, it is Singapore Airlines. They are one of those at the top. And I knew that for me, for the crew, we could all be relaxed knowing that the airline has deemed it safe. But then I get on board and the crew immediately is like, oh, we're so nervous. We wish we were just going straight back to Singapore tonight and not staying over. We're really worried the flight's going to be canceled tomorrow. And I was like, guys, now I'm nervous.
They shouldn't have said that to you.
To be fair, I was probably the one who brought it up, and then they sort of, the floodgates just opened. But the flight was completely unimpacted, and we landed. You wouldn't notice anything besides the news, which was obviously going off. It wasn't until the next day, because then, obviously, now I'm in London, so I flew Delhi to Heathrow. All airlines are severely impacted on that route at the moment, because all flights are basically fly south for an hour and a half until they reach the airspace of Mumbai before turning sort of northwest and continuing onward toward the Middle East. And then our flight ended up going over Iran. So Air India flies the A350 on most of their frequencies to London. But they have very few A350s. So what's happened is that because of this, they've just had these massive compounding delays. So my flight was delayed 5 hours. Yay! In addition to a then over 10-hour flight time, an hour and a half longer than originally scheduled. So
at what point was your flight delayed 5 hours?
The night before, they delayed it 3.5 hours. But of course, you know how you and I are. We both can figure out way before an airline tells us what's going to be happening. So I saw that my A350 that was scheduled to operate the next day would be landing after our scheduled departure in Delhi. So I was like,
a little bit of a hint as to the state of play for your departure time.
100%. So I was like, not going to happen. I wasn't surprised by that. But then the next day, I saw the aircraft just ended up, it basically was delayed by like 3 extra hours at Heathrow for no understandable reason.
Well, it was because of the airspace. I mean, you know, the reality is, even though the conflict and the attacks have mostly been occurring during the night, airspace has been, I mean, Pakistan's airspace, a massive key overflight area between east and west, that has been closing and reopening and closing and reopening periodically over, it happens sometimes multiple times in a day. So there are always these alerts whereby they suddenly close airspace and aircraft have to deviate away. Now, most airlines are not overflying Pakistan right now because of the way in which their airspace is opening and closing at the last minute, and there's no sense of planning that can be done. You wouldn't be sensible if you were operating now for the safety and security of an airline that has the choice to route elsewhere around Pakistan, either taking a more northern route or a southern route and so on. You're just not factoring in Pakistan's airspace right now because of those last minute closures. So I would imagine that combined with all the other risk factors is the reason for those delays. That is the reason for those delays.
Well, the airspace was already closed. I think you're being very nice by giving Air India the benefit of the doubt, because BA and Virgin were departing on time. So I just think that although the aircraft...
I mean, Air India have their reasons, don't they? They don't need a conflict with Pakistan.
No, to be 5 hours delayed. Let's just say that.
Unfortunately.
So then it just kept getting compounded. And I don't know if you've ever
experienced this. Did you arrive to the airport later because you knew about the delay?
Well, I was sleeping at the airport overnight. They have a transit hotel airside.
Right.
So I didn't even, you know, clear immigration or anything. It just meant, okay, we get some more sleep. But I feel like you haven't maybe been in these situations because you don't go to any war zones or dangerous places, which I don't blame you for. But it was like a familiar feeling from a few times when Oscar and I were traveling to 100 countries of as we were pushing back into like when you can start to taste that, okay, we're about to leave, we're about to be able to fully exhale. That's when it gets really stressful because as we're taxiing, we're just like, okay, let's just go. Let's just go. Like any, it just suddenly feels like anything could happen at any minute. And then,
but that's, I mean, that's everywhere these days. Like that is the reality. But previously we would say that, oh, you know, you would have that feeling if you were about to depart on an aircraft from Congo or from, you know, from Ivory Coast back in the day or somewhere more associated with ongoing conflict. Now these things happen everywhere, just across Asia, across Europe, you know, across any entity, any state, sorry, where you may be reliant on airspace of a country that is currently weaponizing airspace.
You're 100% right. So we had an excruciating 45-minute taxi where...
What?
Yeah, don't ask me why it took so long. They were spacing out departures 8 minutes between takeoffs. I could not fathom why. There were like three aircraft in front of us and they were spacing it out so much. And I was just like, let's go. And then suddenly, like after 30 minutes or so, a massive storm pulls in and it starts pouring.
Of course it does.
And I'm like, okay, great. Now we're going to be even more held back. And so finally we took off and I was just counting the altitude. I was like, okay, 10,000 feet, good. 20,000 feet, even better. 30,000, we're off, baby. And it was just...
But you see how, I mean, look at you, like desperate to get out of there. And yet this is a country where you have lived, where you spend time, where you visit friends and family. Like, you know, you're so familiar with it, but just because of what it's going through this week specifically, and hopefully it won't be for the long term, you just I guess you just come to realize how fragile everything is.
You're so right, because the fragility is the scary thing, because I would never be worried about transiting in India. I've never had that thought before, and now suddenly, like, between me booking the flights a week before taking them and then getting on board, everything changes, and suddenly you can be concerned. And it's one thing with, you know, us who are choosing to fly somewhere or whatever, but always in these situations feel most bad for the crew, specifically obviously at international airlines where they have just been rostered a destination that suddenly seems unstable or unsafe. And I know that in Pakistan, for example, a BA777 was stranded when they closed their airspace. And my thought immediately goes to, oh my gosh, these poor cabin crew who were just, you know, given that flight, but they have no idea if it will proceed as planned tomorrow or if they could be trapped there for a few days, or who knows, for ages if the war escalates. It's a horrifying thought, I feel.
You know, I mean, and as I say, you know, we always mention about how aviation is so incredibly linked. Look at the US withdrawal of Afghanistan, right? And that crazy dysfunctional withdrawal that was just a complete and utter mess and a global embarrassment, but also how caught up. I mean, the whole story was centered around the airport and the aircraft that just happened to fly in on that day. You know, some of the airline planning teams seemingly aware that it was likely that the Taliban were going to be able to approach Kabul as fast as they did, but many being dismissive of that, saying they won't get those gains and there will be no sudden withdrawal and it won't be chaotic. And of course, it was all of those things. And we had that Turkish Airlines aircraft in with all that crew, and there are bombs going off on either side. And, you know, as you say, for those crew members, it was just another destination on their roster for that day. You know, wake up, get ready, go to the aircraft as normal. Never probably imagining that they would be caught up in a global, you know, a global bit of conflict that will go down in history. And there they are in the middle of it just because they you know, committed to being able to serve 200 or so passengers and take meal preferences. And obviously they're there for much more than that. We respect them in everything that crew are not just qualified for, but are there for the safety and security and well-being of passengers. But thankfully, aviation, in business as usual, they don't have to do much of that at all. And it's just all the nice bits. So the fact that they're caught up in something so awful, you're right. I feel for the crew in those situations.
Yeah, I mean, the Afghanistan situation was especially excruciating to watch from an aviation perspective, because so many people were so desperate to get out. And at the same time, it was so dangerous to fly in. And I remember sitting there as everything was unfolding live on Flight Radar 24, tracking this Emirates 777 back when Emirates flew to Kabul, that was circling for hours. And you were just wondering, like, are they really going to try to land right now? And then ultimately, they decided to return to Dubai for the crews and the passengers and everyone's safety. But then imagine the people sitting there in the terminal who have checked in, waiting for their Emirates flight to get out of there as all this horrible stuff is unfolding. And then if they're tracking the flight and suddenly they see a turnaround and leave, I cannot picture a more horrifying feeling when you're so close to getting out and then, you know, your ride just turns around. Crazy sometimes how aviation, it really has such a vital role in, you know, people's survival.
Yeah, all roads lead to it. I mean, you remember, and you're from the region anyway, you remember when Russia was not allowing Norwegian to overfly when Norwegian was having that growth out of London and they wanted to fly from London to Southeast Asia or the Far East, and they needed the Siberian corridor access, and Russia were in full control of that and basically said no, or rather didn't give them a response at that time. These were like the early indications of how important and prominent airspace is from those early case studies. And I say early in recent commercial aviation history. Very, very minor, small indications. I remember the Financial Times leading with a piece asking why Norwegian wasn't given, because at the time there was no clear kind of falling out or disagreement perhaps between the UK government and Russia, and so things were pretty okay, or as okay as they could have been for that period, and so that was a bit unclear. And then of course we've seen it everywhere in the Middle East. We've seen it across South America as well. I mean, there are even airspace disputes that continue today. I was just reading a briefing recently, again, between Spain, Morocco, and of course, Gibraltar. In the middle of it all, Gibraltar, the rock, the overseas British small little territory.
The Rock, that, Dwayne the Rock Johnson is just...
It is Gibraltar, the Rock of Gibraltar. Actually, have you been to Gibraltar?
No. Have you?
Okay. Yes, yeah, a few times. So if you... Malaga, of course, is in the south of Spain, right? And then if you continue along the coast, if you're looking at the map and you go west along the coast, then you pass by all of the hotspot areas. So you pass by the likes of Marbella, and then you continue Estepona, and you continue, and you end up at Gibraltar. Gibraltar is a UK overseas territory, and it has a hard border, essentially. So you go through immigration, you cross over. But the reason why it's of interest, and I thought you may have been, is because it's really prominent in aviation. It's one of the most extreme airports to land at because of the short runway, the massive Rock of Gibraltar on one side, and this wind, the Levanter, that is incredibly turbulent and has this wind shear, crosswind in the last final seconds of the final approach. Most aircraft that set out for Gibraltar, and British Airways fly there daily, just end up diverting to Malaga. And that's just the reality of it. It's so difficult to land at. And also, the main road as you enter from Spain crosses the runway. And so that's always interesting. You can literally walk across the runway as a pedestrian. And this is an active runway, active airport. And how it links to airspace is that the approach and the departure sequence is complicated even further by the fact that because it is the UK, categorically, it is Great Britain, Spain do not want the aircraft immediately entering Spanish airspace, either in the usually in the departure sequence. So there is this tight turn straight away after departure. The whole thing is just an extreme mess. And again, it is fueled by that political tension between Spain and Gibraltar over the rights of the rock and if it should be UK territory. And how does it, where does the impact fall out? Of course, onto aviation and onto these extreme, you know, turning turbulent approaches and departures from this little airport.
Yeah, very interesting. But I said I haven't been to Gibraltar. I didn't say I don't know what Gibraltar is because I
feel
like
it's for the benefit of the listeners.
Yes, that's good. Because as an av geek, I think most people know how iconic that airport is. I'm sure you, as I have flown into it in Flight Simulator so many times as when we were younger. Because, that was, I mean, the fact that there was a road in the middle of the runway is crazy.
Someone put on Instagram yesterday, it was so he's a guy I follow, and he put on his story. He said, they told us that we are delayed because we have to have the right weather conditions because the runway is too short where we're going. He was like, here's a thought, build a longer runway, right? So I just saw it and I was like, okay, next, right? And then about 4 hours later, I see he was landing at Madeira. And I was laughing because Madeira is literally a runway built on stilts in the water where aircraft get battered by crosswind. You know, little did he know, perhaps, that actually he was flying again into one of the world's most extreme airports.
Yeah. Would you feel comfortable flying into Madeira, since I know you're a little bit cautious about stuff?
I would, but I would be selective about what airline I'm flying to Madeira on. I mean,
Does BA fly there?
Does BA fly to Madeira? I think they used to seasonally, and perhaps they still do seasonally. Yes, I think they still do, but definitely over recent years in the summer season they have. I would, but I would be selective. Don't forget, I've also flown to all of the Azores Islands, and some of those are famous for, again, short runways. They look like Madeira, loads of crosswind. Some of them I was in a little Dash 8 being, you know, thrown about on the finals, in this kind of windy, you know, the nine or so islands in the middle of the Atlantic. So yeah, no, I would. Madeira would be like that.
The good old days of you flying Dash 8s. I feel like, you know, once you spend a lot of time outside of the West, you get so, like, you get such a distorted sense of what is a normal aircraft size for something. When you're in Asia, you're like, yeah, of course there's a 787 on this 1 hour flight. Or in the Middle East, of course there's an A380 on this flight. And then you're like, wait, a Dash 8 on a multiple hour long flight? Is this a joke?
I mean, the Dash 8 is the extreme example. When I'm in Canada and I look at the departure board and I see that this flight is going to Vancouver from Montreal and it's like so many hours, and I look at A319. The aircraft outside, I'm like, what? You know, we do that same duration on A380s. We do that. And if you're in Asia, I mean, well, you're blessed with every wide body in the world. So it's you're right. Different markets. If you are firmly flying in your home market, perhaps you have a different idea to air travel than someone else in a different part of the world. That's
100%. And I think this brings us to another fascinating headline from this week, which is that Emirates has now become the world's most profitable airline. A fully wide body airline that flies A380s on 2 hour flights is now, I mean, we can't really say that these financial results are directly comparable to airlines in the West because of the different cost structures, but it is a fascinating thing that we're at a point now where, you know, a decade ago, all Middle Eastern airlines were, you know, not only not hugely profitable, but many were making enormous losses. And now we're at a point where Emirates is really raking it in.
We're in a sweet spot, definitely. Most airlines globally of Emirates' scale will be announcing this year incredible profits. You know, we're reaching new levels of financial success in aviation because of the way in which demand has maintained its strength over such a period of time now, basically since 2022. Emirates becoming the world's most profitable is definitely an achievement. And it's the Emirates Group, as you say. This is why it's not always directly, you can't always compare it to as in a like for like example to a US carrier or a European carrier because of the different elements of the group, the divisions and what it includes, but also the cost structure, as you said. And that means the fees that Emirates has to pay at home, for example, or any of the associated costs at their hub in Dubai and the operations there. However, that doesn't take away from the fact that these are impressive financial results. As you said, world's most profitable so far. And again, I think this is the first of several airlines that will be able that we will be able to discuss having reached new levels of financial strength, apart from Singapore Airlines, actually, because Singapore Airlines, where they had their most profitable year, I think ever last year, in terms of the results they announced for the previous year to last year, that doesn't seem like it's going to be the case for this year. Different airlines have had to factor in different difficulties. Every airline has different challenges, whether you are a customer waiting on deliveries and you're being delayed by the likes of Boeing, whether or not you are situated in an area where there is conflict nearby, and so the geopolitical diversions, you're having to take a hit there. But also, you know, look at something like the complete shutdown of Heathrow Airport. British Airways just revealed in their financial for Q1 that the Heathrow shutdown, just the day, and it wasn't even a full day, but it was most of the day, cost them £40 million. Now, understandably so, that's not a financial hit they want to take. And so you just see again how everything is so fragile. By the way, while we're talking about BA, a nice order for Airbus and Boeing aircraft there from IAG. That was it's always nice to see an airline that doesn't typically place orders so often reinvest a bit of their hard-earned profits to some new aircraft for us, the passengers.
100%. I think this is what anytime an airline announces huge profits, or like in this case Emirates, then yeah. I'm always happy to see that they're investing in something. So now we have BA with, you know, largely the most ancient fleet of 20-plus-year-old A320 family aircraft, 777s that have been flying since before we were born almost.
Yeah.
We
play a game, don't we? When we see those old 777s, you and I are like, older than us.
yeah, exactly. And anytime we see an aircraft that's older than us, we're like, not getting on that.
No.
So, I mean, yes, BA does a great job taking care of them and they're not unsafe or anything like that. Yeah. The cabins are also good, but it's just the comfort is so much higher flying a modern aircraft. The same goes for Emirates. Thank goodness they committed to their retrofit program last year where they're retrofitting hundreds of aircraft in the most expensive large-scale retrofit program in history. Because if they had announced record profits and we would still be sitting there with no planes to reconfigure their 777s, it would have seemed absolutely ridiculous. And that's what I feel about the same with Lufthansa Group. I just posted a video last week saying how I would fix Lufthansa, basically.
Yeah,
and
so
when an airline makes huge profits, it's like, the passengers need to see some of that in the form of improvements, because we're not here to make you the most profitable airline in the world. We're here to fly an airline we enjoy. And if you don't deliver that, then we'll fly another one. It's as simple as that.
There was an interesting part of the IAG order in relation to the order that is specific to British Airways that I want to make a little, I wanted to put it on the record here on the podcast. I think the Boeing 787-10 is about to have its moment. And I say that because the true value of the A321 wasn't realized until much later. And that was because airlines suddenly woke up to how you could have kind of slightly longer range performance with short haul and single aisle economics, it being incredibly efficient and so on. With the 787-10, this is an aircraft variant that is not yet so common globally. And the 787-9 and the original 787, which is the 787-8, both perform better because there are so many active and about globally, and they've been about for so many years. However, the 787-10 provides airlines with something that the other two variants don't, and that is capacity. So where the 787-10 is not able to fly further for a greater distance or fly longer than the longer routes than the likes of the Dash 9 or the Dash 8, it is somewhat limited there in terms of performance. It is able to increase the number of passengers any airline is able to get on board. Capacity is greater. And I think the BA order is the beginning of us seeing airlines realize the true potential of this aircraft in an era with so much uncertainty over the other Boeing aircraft that promises capacity, the 777X, that has a big fat question mark next to it in terms of whenever it will be able to be delivered. So I think this Dash 10 is now kind of taking that pole position purely because it is able to offer airlines capacity. Boeing isn't constrained in terms of its production of 787s. There are issues, but nowhere near to the extent on the 777X program. And so they're able to pump them out faster from the Carolinas and get them to the rest of the world. And that's why I think that we probably are going to see more of that over the coming year.
I mean, I agree. And also, I'm equally surprised every time I fly an A350-900. I'm like, why is this the most common variant? Why is this the one that all these airlines have? Why is this the one that Emirates has committed to, Air India? Like, it's the same thing. The 351,000 has better unit cost. I know that for certain regions, the engines are having issues compared to the 900. But it shouldn't be that significant that it's like all airlines are going in for that. So I guess we might see the same with the A350, going forward as well.
Yeah. No. And then, of course, as part of the IAG order, there are some other bits and pieces. Some 330 Neos going to Aer Lingus and Iberia and Level.
Do airlines order those just because they're cheap? Or like, why is anyone buying an old A330 Neo? No one wants to fly those compared to an A350 or a 787.
I would say the quick answer there is that obviously they are cheaper than the A350. And also, don't forget, airlines are never paying list price. So if you go online now and check what the list price is of a 330 Neo, they're not paying that. So they're able to get a good deal on an aircraft that isn't selling like crazy, but it has a solid sales record. They're able to get the aircraft much faster than others. So I would say it's purely about capacity and increasing capacity in order to hold on to demand while things are good globally. And in terms of demand, things continue to be good globally. But we know that that can change so quickly. So I would say, that is more to do with just being able to introduce an aircraft faster than the likes of the competition, even the competition within the same manufacturer, and therefore increase capacity as quickly as you can in order to hold on to some of that good demand.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're in an era where you and I are used to, we step on long haul and it's generally a 777, an A350 or a 787. So on the occasion where you board an A330, you're just like, you see the window and you're just like, what is that? Why is it like my iPhone? This is not something we want in 2025.
But it's like when you do. I still get this today. If I spend a lot of time on my iPad and then I immediately go to the iPhone suddenly looks like this big.
Yeah.
Like it just was absolutely tiny. Feels like that when you board a 330. I want to ask you about this. I saw this and then this made me laugh because you and I have been traveling since we were in diapers, and I look at me using American terminology, and
nappies.
There was a little mishap on a Cathay Pacific flight where a flight from Hong Kong to London, a three-year-old was mistakenly served white wine instead of water in business class. Okay, so firstly, easily done ish. I mean, Evian white wine. I don't know how that was mixed up, but I can see a scenario, I guess, maybe in a dark cabin and, crew are pouring a lot of drinks. The funny part, I thought, was that the error was quickly corrected. How? Because the three-year-old said it didn't taste like water and informed the parents. I mean, that was funny. The fact that, that this three-year-old could have just continued it and thought that this is what water tastes like on Cathay Pacific from Hong Kong to London.
Yeah, so this raised a lot of questions for me. I just have to check because I haven't actually checked the timings of this flight. Okay, it's exactly what I suspected. It leaves at midnight, so it's an overnight flight.
So it's overnight. Okay.
And the obvious explanation here is just, you hear crew talk about this all the time, the brain fog, the fatigue that comes with working an overnight flight. So I 100% understand how when you're completely exhausted and in a daze,
I'm laughing. Sorry, that I'm laughing about something else. Go on.
Yeah, I understand how it can happen. Of course, it wasn't intentional. And of course, the kid wasn't like, I want wine. And then that's what the crew gave them, yeah. Which is what I was like, is that what happened when I read the headline?
Well, I was thinking that this is why I'm stupidly laughing while you're talking, is that I was thinking that, you know, it was an overnight flight and they are tired individuals because they work really hard. You know, was this kid a little bit loud? And they thought, right, something to gently, you know, gently let him wind down a bit and sleep. I mean, obviously, this is a joke. I'm by no way, you know, seriously implying that Cathay were trying to gently, you know, intoxicate their three-year-old with a little white wine before bed. But it's funny because when we were kids, so for example, when I was able to travel alone on BA for the first time, and I was able to, you know, go about without any parent with me, that was at age 16, right? And I used to always have this issue where I would, if I was flying business class, I would go into the lounge, and then 50% of the time, no one would say anything. The other 50% of the time, the lounge attendants would realize that I'm a kid and there's an open bar there. Help yourself. And of course, you know, in that weird kind of gray area scenario, do the rules of the homeland apply? Well, in that area, it is actually yes. But then BA, is it, you know, was the BA lounge a private premise where they were able to offer it on a private? Well, yes. And anyway, it was a gray area. So 50% of the time it was fine. No one bothered me. And also, for the record, at 16, I was not, you know, heading over to help myself with alcohol. I don't do that now, let alone then. And I was just kind of, you know, going about as normal. The other 50% of the time, I remember this woman shouted across the lounge and she was like, "You can't be in here." Why? She was like, "Because there's alcohol and you're too young." And I'm like, "Excuse me, lady, I have an orange juice." You know, but yeah.
This is
out the lounge. I was escorted because there was this kind of gray area. So, did you ever have that?
Oh wow, no, I did not have that. Although I did, so very different because I had an era of thinking I'm going to be all adult and drink wine now, and I had a bit of a party phase. And that was like, then I felt like it was
a whole episode dedicated to that.
We do. But then I felt like it was the biggest life hack in some countries like Germany or France or Italy, where they're more casual about drinking, especially at younger ages. I would be like, "Give me a wine, please," when I was 16 and something, and it would always be fine. And that always makes me think of, like, you know, Americans, how it's like, first of all, everyone's delusional and thinks that their kids haven't had a sip of alcohol until they turn 21. And
21.
Then there's like, there's like that time, "Oh, your first sip, honey." Like, yeah, sure. But I always wonder when those
Did you have
people...
that? I mean, you're the American on the podcast.
My dad is not delusional.
There's no videos of your first sip.
No, maybe there are, but I would have been 16 at a party. So,
goodness.
But my point is that I always wonder when those Americans board like ETA Airways. Yeah. Or Air France or something, and like the kids probably don't know, but they would be totally allowed to drink, and then there would be this whole thing because different airlines have different ages, but no airline allows three-year-olds to drink. So that's the point.
No, it's not even Cathay Pacific, God bless them.
No, and I think this family is being well taken care of by the airline. They were offered a refund for the kids' ticket and upgrade vouchers. The parents are still not satisfied, but I think that is definitely more than enough for the airline to do.
The parents are not satisfied because the three-year-old complained about the quality of the wine. She just said she expected more on an overnight from Hong Kong.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Is this the decline of Cathay Pacific?
I wonder if... Actually, I think they were in the Aria suite. Lucky Pew, this is an Aria suite flight number. So, lucky folks. Let's go into Q&A. If you ever stay at luxury hotels, whether or not you have status at those hotel chains, I recommend going to nonstopdan.com/hotels to check out booking your future luxury hotel stays there. Because by booking through a travel advisor like us, you will get a bunch of more benefits at luxury hotels, like daily breakfast for two, room upgrades subject to availability, early check-in and late checkout, a $100 property credit or food and beverage credit, a welcome amenity, VIP status at the hotel, and if you already have status, this will give you even higher priority for upgrades. In fact, people booking through travel advisors get the highest priority for upgrades at hotels. So once again, go to nonstopdan.com topdan.com/hotels to book your next luxury hotel stay. So I have a question here from Emilian, which this is actually so relatable. A question I have too. Yeah. Very serious aviation question. Is the coat hanger in on economy class seats just there for some emotional support, or do people actually use them? I feel like it's the most optimistic feature on the whole plane. I agree. Those little things. People don't even realize
what it is. People don't realize it's a coat hook. You're right. Also, in economy, it's like, it means everything is right there hanging in front of you if you do hang it up. So, but I do think people, I see people in Club Europe on BA when you've got the empty middle seat, use it. You know, the ones who are like traveling their blazer and take it off. And but otherwise, I think it's wildly optimistic for the majority of the flying public.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to have because what is a way, but I feel like, maybe there should at least be a little note that says this is a like coat hook so that people know what it actually is so they use it. I have another question here from Mark who has bumped his question, so need to make sure we get to this. I recently experienced a delay on an Iberia flight that qualified for compensation under EU 261. I submitted 3 separate claims directly with Iberia and each one was denied. Eventually, they even blocked me from submitting further claims using my ticket number. Out of frustration, I went through a third-party claims company, and surprisingly, they were able to get me the full compensation within 2 weeks. Why would Iberia deny multiple direct claims from me as an individual and then quickly approve and pay out once a third party was involved? It seems unfair and totally irrational. Is this common practice? Well, I can't say I'm surprised with Iberia, first of all. They are not the most generous airline.
They're kind of rogue when it comes to paying out what they owe. And unfortunately, that is not a sweeping generalization, but more of reality. Yeah. The only thing I might say is that perhaps, you know, giving the benefit of the doubt to the airline, perhaps there was something that was filed slightly incorrectly or communicated slightly incorrectly from the individual side. And then maybe when the agency handled it, they were able to better provide that information or the kind of missing puzzle piece, maybe, but also maybe not. It might just be Iberia-ing.
Exactly. I think that in this case, the third party company, they knew clear cut that this was a case that should be eligible for compensation. And perhaps Iberia knows that the company is willing to take them to court over it. So then when an individual maybe doesn't make it clear that I'm willing to go to consumer protections or this and that, but a third party gets involved, it's taken more seriously. And then they think, okay, we have to deal with this.
Yeah.
Now, final question, because we actually were going to get to this as a topic today. So it's perfect that Matt asks.
Yes.
What is going on with Newark? Explain like I'm 5, please.
Okay. I mean, as the American in the podcast, I think you're able to better do that. Go on, take it away, and then I'll add you in case you miss anything.
So my New Yorker side will say it's a fucking shit show. That's what it is.
It is.
But that, I wouldn't say that to a 5-year-old. What I would say to them is you have a bunch of computers and people controlling the planes in the sky. What has happened is that sometimes the computers just randomly turn off and the people controlling the planes can't see anything for a minute or 2 minutes. But meanwhile,
because
the
computers are old. Right?
Yeah, the computers are older than you, 5-year-old, way older than anything. And you have all these planes that are still flying around in the sky. And just because the computer stops does not mean that the planes stop. So suddenly the planes have no guidance from air traffic control that are supposed to be telling the planes, fly this direction, do that, do this. So, of course, it's an extremely concerning situation because the main body that's supposed to be checking that everything is okay is suddenly without power and cannot do anything.
I would say that was explained perfectly. And that, because there is that kind of question mark at the end, there is no solution yet. There's no happily ever after. They are trying to figure out what they're going to do and to overhaul. And I hope that there is systematic overhaul that the Trump administration is promising. We can touch on that a bit more. Also, next week's episode, we're going to look at what eventually is going to happen with this Trump visit to the Middle East and the aviation implications there. We're expecting an aircraft order. We're expecting things with Saudi. There's this whole talk of the 747 that they're gifting to Trump for Air Force One? Is it for Air Force One and then a president after? Is it only for Trump? Everything's super unclear today, but by the time we regroup next week, we'll have all of the takeaways and discussion on that. And he would have been to the Middle East as well, so undoubtedly there'll be stuff to discuss there, because he's going to three aviation heavyweights in terms of, well, two of them very established, UAE and Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, quick up and coming in the aviation world. So we'll take a look at what happens from his little vacation in those three states.
Exactly. I wonder if by the time he leaves, he's going to also realize what we know already, that the brand is Riyadh, the brand is Riyadh, the brand is Riyadh.
And on that branding note, with Riyadh being the brand, we will say we thank you for joining us once again, and we'll regroup the same time, same place next week. See you later, guys.
See you then on air. Bye-bye.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.